Could you start by letting us know what it is that you do?
Okay, I work in CSIRO Land and Water, and I work as part of the Environmental Information Infrastructure Group within Land and Water, and I'm responsible for leading a piece of work which we call social architecture, which is around working with government and industry and other actors to try to improve the flow of environmental and other kinds of information around a data ecosystem.
Why do you call it social architecture?
Look, I think because in the past we tend to focus on technical architectures in the digital space. We build information systems, and there's a lot of emphasis on the design of technical aspects of the system. We focus on information engineering as well, which is information architecture. But there's a need increasingly for these very large complex systems to start thinking about the social, institutional and economic aspects of data and how data flows in the ecosystem and how people are incentivized and disincentivized to share data, what their attitudes to sharing data are, what some of the barriers to enabling data sharing are. So it's trying to build an integrated approach to addressing those issues so that when we do build systems, they're built in a way that works with existing business practice and culture and encourages the kinds of outcomes that we're looking for.
Okay. And when you say data ecosystem, what does that mean?
So the term kind of reflects the fact that there are in any given domain, across society, in any given industry, thousands and thousands of different information systems. And for most things that we do, most decisions we're looking for, most analysis, we need to be able to pull data from lots of different places. So each individual system contains some data. It may have some functionality that enables a user to get the answer they want, but typically we need to pull data together from lots and lots of different information systems. So we think about the data ecosystem in the way that we think about kind of in biodiversity and ecosystems as natural ecosystems.
And where does all of the data live?
The data in my world, I tend to work particularly with government. So in the environmental space, data lives in state and territory government agencies, it lives in Commonwealth government agencies, it's generated in some large, what I refer to as information factories in Commonwealth government, the likes of the Bureau of Meteorology for climate data, Geoscience Australia, ABS, Australian Bureau of Statistics, is another agency that generates a lot of this data. Increasingly, we're looking at data that's held in private hands. So for example, in the agriculture space, there's an awful lot of soil sample data that's held by labs, by testing labs. The data's owned by farmers, and the data, if we could get hold of it and aggregate it and use it in public goods space, we could start to improve soil maps, national soil maps, and improve the quality and accuracy of these soil maps. So increasingly we're starting to look at the role of this privately held data in industry and small to medium enterprise hands.
Okay, and so it's held in different hands, and you've given one example of soil data. What does it look like? You know, when we talk about data, what information are we talking about?
Again, so in my world, in the environmental space, we're typically talking about spatial data. So it's data that is describing the shape or characteristics of things on the land or under the land or even in the air, the atmosphere. And typically there's a geometric element, so the shape of the things that we're looking at. And then there's often in different systems, there's the observations and measurements of environmental phenomena. So at a particular point, at a dam, how much water is flowing. Or another example could be, at a particular point in on the landscape, what are the soil chemistry characteristics? So it's typically spatial data, but a whole world of related, sometimes connected, sometimes disconnected, samples and observations which tell us what is at that point.
And this is all in this sort of ecosystem of multiple holders of information.
Exactly. And it could be many different databases under one system within one organization. I think one of the problems we face in Australia, one of the challenges is really around how do we effectively aggregate data from the states and territories to produce national data sets? Because every state and territory collects data in a different way. So if you think about the road network, the way that you characterize roads, the individual mapping processes, whether you call it a dual carriageway or a two-lane road, pretty much everything about how we collect the data is done in a different way. And there's a cost imposed on national agencies to try and put that data together. And we see that pattern in every single domain. So in geosciences and environmental sciences, in health, in education, those similar kinds of challenges exist. So pulling together national data sets becomes quite expensive. And there's a critical role for standards in that process to agree on how we can share data, what we call a particular phenomena, how we classify a road or how we classify vegetation types.
So it's often said that we're living in an era of big data. What actually does that mean?
Look, there are a variety of different definitions of big data. The one I prefer is we talk about the three V's of big data. So it's volume, variety, and velocity. So the data volumes are growing. Data sets, individual data sets are growing in size. We have enormous amounts of new satellite imagery data, which is used a lot in environmental and other sciences to help us get a picture of what's happening. There's velocity. So the speed at which data is coming in. So in the past, satellites would pass over a given point every 26 days, and now you're getting repeat visits on a daily basis. So the speed at which data is coming in. Think of Facebook data or Twitter. And the third V is the variety. So in the past, we had more formal, authoritative sources of data, and now we're getting new kinds of data. We're getting data which are, you could think of as digital smoke signals. So they're the transactions of citizens going about their business on the web. Your browser history, the way you interact with retailers online, the way you interact with government services. So those kinds of data as well, very new data. So big data is a combination of all of those things, which kind of creates a bit of a data deluge and creates a lot of problems in terms of governing the data, doing the right thing with the data, managing the data, pulling it together so that you can do smart things with it, and then, of course, interpreting the results depending on the kind of data that you use, whether it's formal, curated, authoritative data, or whether you're exploring the use of new kinds of data to answer questions in new ways. And there's a lot of interest in machine learning and artificial intelligence to be able to help us analyze and process very, very large volumes of data.
So is it a new era? I mean, is it that significant that it's so different to the way we used to manage data before?
I think so. I think the volumes have grown. I think fundamental aspects of the way that data is generated are really different as well. So there's an enormous interest in kind of social data, and that I think presents a great deal of challenge for government. I think we're seeing an awful lot of digital disruption in some industries where there are lots of opportunities to capture information spaces and to control information and control of the information about a supply chain in industry gives you a lot of power in purchasing and the real goods supply chain that you're involved with. So we see, for example, Climate Corp being bought out by Monsanto, and then Monsanto being bought out by Bayer. So these interconnected purchases of these data markets, effectively.
So does that mean that even though there's a lot of an incredible amount of data and volume, velocity,
variety.
Yep. I was thinking veracity. Well, veracity is another.
Well, some people talk about some people actually talk about that fourth R as well, which is veracity, which is, you know, is this a true picture of what's going on?
Mm. So four V's.
Four V's. Yeah, we haven't got a fifth yet.
But is it is all this data available for us to use, or is it?
No, there are still some significant challenges in accessing data. It lives in this ecosystem in lots of different places. Some of the data lives in public good space, so it's accessible, more accessible than other forms of data. Some data is locked up in privately owned platforms, the likes of Facebook or things in Google space. Some data is held within government systems and historically hasn't been released. I think moves in the open government, open data space have provided really some important incentives to change the default setting around data, which is that things should be open by default, provided government respects the rights of individuals and deals with these issues of de-identification of data, making sure that personally identifiable data isn't released, and doing some fairly rigorous risk assessment work to look at what are the risks of re-identification. Because often one might release a data set and not know what other data sets could be later released, which could be put together to help you re-identify someone. So there are some emerging techniques to understand how one can do a more rigorous risk assessment and protect the rights of individuals. So I think there are some fairly significant challenges still in the supply chains, data that's held within public and private organizations. I think there are challenges in taking those different volumes of data and the differently structured data and integrating it.
Risks associated with this new sort of data era?
Yeah, look, I think the majority of risks really lie in data that relates to people or businesses and the risk of release of information which may disbenefit the subjects of the data. So I think those are the kind of the primary risks. And within government, it's possible to pull personal information together, the kind of data that government collects to administer its services in health and education, for example. And it can do that in closed, safe spaces and use that information to better provide services to citizens. But there's also kind of a benefit to releasing some of that data more to research community, to improve transparency and accountability around decision making, and that desire to make that data more openly available has to be balanced against the disincentive or the disbenefit that could accrue to the people who are the subject of the data. And this could be discrimination against people, it could be reputational damage, a whole range of things.
So from a government policy perspective, there are tensions in this sort of open by default philosophy and also not wanting to disbenefit people, as you say.
Absolutely. I think in this wrapped up in this concept of data democracy, the same way in the political system you have, you know, fundamental principle of democracy is the right to participate in political decision making. I think a key in this data democracy concept is the rights around data. So citizens have rights, consumers have rights, it's data about themselves. Government manages, takes responsibility for managing those data rights on behalf of citizens. Private sector is held to a slightly different account and can set some rules a little bit, it has a bit more leeway than government. Privacy Act and those things still apply, but it can set the rules on its platforms, like for example Facebook, which people, when they sign up, they sign over the ownership of their data, for example. And government is a slightly different case. We're held to a much higher account, rightly so, because we hold very sensitive data.
So when you say data for the public good, what are the benefits? What are the potential benefits?
So I think, again, depending on the kind of data, in principle, I would say the benefits are really around, if it's government data, primarily it's around improved service provision, policy, decision-making processes, that is enabled, and that's within kind of, that's government use of data and cross-agency potentially. So I think the flows of benefit back to citizens are in improved service delivery and the economy and society and environment benefits from that. I think at an individual level, citizens are seeing more personalized services. There's a desire now to wrap services around citizens, and a lot of digital transformation in government is really focused on that. In my space, we see a lot of benefit in making data that is available to decision makers in the environment space more widely and openly available. I think there are innovation outcomes in that space. If the data is available, you don't have the transaction cost of going and collecting the data yourself. You can, business can innovate on top at a very low cost. So I think there are some innovation outcomes there. And in terms of the relationship between citizens and government, I think there are some clear kind of transparency and accountability benefits in having access to available data within the rights-based approach. You know, if people have a right to see that data, and if it doesn't disbenefit citizens.
So you're talking about, in your space, the land and water space, this idea of low transaction or high transaction costs being a disincentive. What, can you unpack that a little bit? What do you mean when you're talking about that?
If it's something I refer to as I think there are two things. So firstly, we touched on earlier this idea that state and territory governments in whatever domain collect data, manage data, and deliver it in a way which meets their local needs within each state and territory, but they are all different. So at a national level, there's a need to harmonize and integrate that data. So there's cost there. That's a high transaction cost. So if, for example, I wanted to develop a national environmental monitoring system and I had to take data from all of the states and territories to do that, I would have to negotiate access to that data. I'd have to download it to my environment. I would need to interpret the data. I would need to determine whether in two data sets people were talking about the same concept of a year, for example, whether it's a financial year or a calendar year, whether it's a water accounting year, whose calendar year, whose financial year. So even a well understood concept like year has some difficulties in it. So all of those represent transaction costs in actually finding the data, negotiating access to it, and then in harmonizing it, bringing it into a national consistent framework, structure, and meaning. Then, and only then, can I start to think about building that application. Now, if every single application developer has to take on that same cost, it means that there's a very, very high transaction cost in innovation. So the platforms and the attempts that we're involved with to try to improve the accessibility of data, the delivery, the standardization of data, are intended to reduce the transaction cost for all users of the data.
So this is why standards are important?
Correct, yeah, absolutely critical. So the role of standards are, standards are a social process. They ensure that if we wanted to produce, for example, a national product, but we didn't want all of the states and territories to change everything that they're doing, we can develop an exchange standard on top. And that means that we effectively map the structure of all of the different states and territories data to a common agreed model so that we can then exchange the data. It doesn't impact the information systems and the business as usual for each of the jurisdictions, but it enables us to have a common language for exchanging data. And then the process of building national collections is very straightforward, and you've reduced the barrier to entry of everybody having to do that for themselves. And you know, it's what we consider to be a very large hidden cost in the economy.
And how far are we on the journey of reducing that transaction cost?
It varies greatly. So depending on the phenomena, you know, if in the geosciences, geologic maps, there have been standards in place, and there's for 100 years of cartographic geology standards. The community has a long track record of collaborating. The phenomena they're dealing with, geology is over, you know, very large scale phenomena. So there's a strong history and necessity of collaborating. So there, the standards are very mature. In other domains where, for example, you might have fast evolving or continually evolving science in the field of ecology, for example, where we're still trying to understand and explore more about how ecology works and what drives ecologic processes, the data standards are perhaps less mature. The community is a lot more fragmented. Understanding how we collect data about ecology is very different. It's different in different jurisdictions, and there are lots of standardization efforts in the environment space. So it's highly variable. I think probably in formal government reporting in statistical space, the standards are very well established. Data exchange standards around population and economic reporting, those kinds of things are pretty well established. In the health sector, I think they're quite well established. So highly variable. And the degree to which standards have been developed and adopted is also a function of the business drivers a little bit. So is there a really strong demand for the data that's generated? So if there's strong business cases and it's a really important aspect of what government does, then there's a tendency to tendency for standards to be developed in those spaces.
So where do you see the current challenges that need to be addressed?
Look, I'll comment on my area, which is really around trying to understand the in the social and institutional and economic space. So I think there are still some we have some way to go to understand what people's attitudes are around data, because they vary tremendously. There are, before we can actually design the institutional mechanisms, the policies and the standards, we need better information about where people are currently at, and that looks very different in different communities. Economics provides a really interesting lens on this also, because it enables us to really start to understand what the value in data is and where cost lies in the system. Because to change what we do and to get data flowing, it requires somebody to take some cost, to bear some cost in the system. So understanding where that cost currently lies and who's best placed to bear that cost to improve the system is important. So it's those three dimensions where I think we haven't done enough work to actually understand that in detail. We build platforms for users. We have a variable success in the adoption and use of those platforms, depending on how well they're structured in the context of this social and institutional and economic environment in which they operate.
I'm fascinated by the different attitudes that people have towards data. Have you got some examples of how people, you know, that you said that there's a variety of attitudes. Have you got any research that says how people perceive data?
So we're commencing a study within our organisation, within CSIRO, looking at attitudes to data. There's a lot that's been written about this in the research community, comparing, and again we'll pick on two domains, space sciences and ecology, where in space sciences and underpinning these two disciplines are these concepts of big data and big science, and little data, little science, small science. So it's the scale of the phenomenon you're observing in space sciences and ecology. In ecology, it may be you're looking at the remaining small population of frogs, and in space sciences, the scale of the phenomena you're looking at is very, very different. The instruments you use and the tools you use to do your science, radio telescopes in one context, and very little equipment in field ecology to go out and actually measure phenomena, those have major impacts in terms of how people collaborate and their attitudes to data. So with space sciences, you need to share equipment. The volumes of data are enormous. There are small communities of space scientists, and they collaborate and have done since the beginning of the discipline, because they need to share the data and interpret enormous volumes of data, and through using shared equipment. In the ecology space, it tends to be a little bit more fragmented, with people studying their own particular species or ecosystems, and the data tends to be locked away a little bit more. It's very, again, there's maybe a lack of standardization in that space, and in the research community, maybe there's a tendency also to hold on to the data until you've written one or more papers about what it is that you're looking at. So I think there's a whole range of behaviors there and incentives and disincentives to share data. Now, in research space, there are the grant funding agencies that fund research are taking an increased interest in data, and are actually setting requirements that if researchers are using grant funding to do their research, that the data gets published along with peer-reviewed papers. So it's the incentive is being driven there by funding agencies.
Interesting. So it's not just open data, it's open science. they're connected.
Yes, yeah. And look, the overall outcome we're after is open open science and openly available data. But the reality is, if somebody has data in a thumb drive in their pocket, it is to all intents and purposes private goods. It's in their pocket, nobody knows about it. It's only when it becomes formally registered, put into a system, made available, that it actually becomes public good, despite what the regulation or policy says. So it's a very hard system to police. Top-down incentives and policies are part of the solution, but a critical part of the solution is actually understanding how to properly incentivize people to encourage them towards pro-sharing behavior. What are the things that we really need to do?
And do you have a gut feeling or a evidence-based feeling on what those things are that will encourage or incentivize the sharing?
Sure. I think in many regards, in research, in government, people understand the value and the need to openly share data. But there's also a transaction cost of doing that. It may be running through the necessary procedural steps to get permission to release the data. Do I have the right to do this? I have to refer back to the contract. What's the policy on ethics? Am I at risk of re-identifying somebody here if I release these data? So running through the cost of running through those processes, reducing those as much as possible by clarifying the process, educating people around what responsibilities they have in regard to data, and then actually developing the necessary tools in data catalogs and data deposit mechanisms which make it easier for people. So one of the great barriers to getting data more openly shared is metadata. The reality is people don't like filling in metadata. It's you know, it's almost a penance. It's a necessary evil, and the I think the harsh reality of metadata is that you know, I bear the cost and somebody else benefits. I don't need metadata for my own data because I know my own data. But so I'm investing my time to benefit someone else. And it's a really significant misalignment of incentives. So we can, for example, develop tools which automate metadata creation. It kind of parses the data and helps us fill in the bits of metadata that can be filled in.
And can you give me an example of what metadata is?
Sure. So it's for a particular data set. Metadata is data about data. So it could be the title, the purpose for which the data was collected, maybe a geographic extent of the data, a description of the accuracy of the data, when it was created, by whom it was created, what kind of instruments were used to create the data. And again, the degree to which the amount of metadata you complete, the more you complete, I'll qualify the term, in general, the more metadata provided, provides more information so that people can determine whether it's the right data for them in a reuse context. So a lot of value in data is around reuse. The base metadata statement says, I know what this data set is, I can determine if it's fit for use for me. If you're within the same discipline area, there's kind of common language and a minimum set of metadata that will help you understand whether it's the right data. If you are in one discipline area and you want to communicate what this data set is about with somebody in a different area, it implies a whole bunch more metadata or a different kind of metadata. And we do want to encourage sharing of data as much as possible.
So as you say, if you're, it's you already know what your data is about, so it's an impost on you to fill all of that out, but mm-hmm. then someone else benefits.
Yep.
So you've got to persuade people or make it easy for them
yep.
to fill that out.
I think the other thing that's happening with the volumes of data, well, currently we've taken a view that we have data sets and metadata, a metadata record for that data set. Typically those metadata records, they're structured in a way that can be machine readable, so you can present it and, you know, you can parse it, but typically, you know, they tend to be human readers who read those that data. We're moving into a paradigm where you can actually start to fragment or make data available as linked data. So rather than having a data set and a metadata record, you can actually publish individual data elements within a data set, which is kind of like publishing having a citation database rather than a library catalog, if that makes sense. So you can reference particular words within a document and provide metadata about that. I don't know if I've explained that particularly well. Maybe
I'm a little bit confused about that one. No, we don't know. We're probably way down into the details. Don't need to give an example. I'm sorry. I've sent you into a...
No, I'm just trying to think of a good way to communicate that. I think what I was trying to say about metadata is with the data deluge that's coming, we need new approaches to metadata. So having the ability to... Because the data volumes are so large, you don't want to have to go and try to trawl through a list of metadata records, download an enormous data set to find out it's the wrong thing. We want to be able to interact machine to machine a little bit more, and we want to be able to go to where the data is and perform a function there. So make a call, interact with the data through a service, and that's the way that we're moving increasingly. So we're trying to avoid shipping the data, we're trying to interact with data through web services.
Okay, so it's this idea of dealing with the mass of it, being smarter, it's being smarter about dealing with the mass of the data in some ways, and that's tracking it in a different, yet more standard way.
I think it's about a couple of things. So, in if you're developing an application, a product that does something on the web, one approach is to take the data you need and to centralize it and pull it into a database so that the functions that the user is using can interact with the underlying data set. That scale, that works for some applications, but it doesn't necessarily scale. So if you need to pull together very large data sets from 15 different organizations, you can't centralize all the data because the underlying data is changing the whole time. So the approach that's increasingly used is to make the source data available from its point of truth by putting a service on top of it. And then you can actually just request the bits of information that you need to meet your application needs. So a single application can call data from multiple different sources.
Okay, but you're not sucking it all in.
You're not centralizing the data necessarily, because that approach doesn't scale, particularly when you're dealing with very large data sets and the data sets are getting updated on a frequent basis.
Mm. No, that makes sense.
And again, it's about reducing transaction cost across the whole system. So that, again, if there are two application developers and each one has to go out and get the data, pull it into their own environment, manage the data locally before they can build their applications, that's a cost to both. If we have better data delivery mechanisms on top of the data, then you're effectively reducing the transaction cost of everybody who wants to use the data for those two purposes, plus the next one and the next one and the next one.
So an investment up front for a cost benefit later.
Exactly. And again, we start to hit this issue that although it reduces the cost across the entire economy, my key performance indicators as a government, managing a database or an information resource, my key performance indicators are not around reducing the cost in the economy. So I'm being asked to invest in building a capability that somebody else will benefit from. And it may not necessarily be my, I may be not necessarily have explicit incentives, implicit or explicit, to do that. So part of the challenge we face in this open data drive in government is actually getting the necessary investment in delivering data in better ways. It's not simply a matter of making your data available via open data catalogs. It's about improving the way that data is provided through web services so that everyone benefits.
So if we come back full circle to this idea of data democracy, if you had to define the concept of data democracy to a layperson, taking into account this whole conversation we've just had, how would you do it?
I think there are probably a couple of different takes on that. I think in general that a definition of data democracy might be equitable access to information for those who have the right to access it. So I don't think we can ever talk about completely free and open data or all data being free and open, because that's more akin to a data anarchy than data democracy. So again, in political thinking about the concept of democracy in political systems, it's about the right to participate in decision-making processes. And likewise in data democracy, it's underpinned fundamentally by rights in data and people having, whether it's personally identified information or commercial and confidence information, there are rights in data that we have to respect. We want, to the degree possible, to make that data open and accessible, but there are constraints on our ability to do that. And fundamentally, it comes down to setting up the governance arrangements around data so that people aren't disbenefited by sharing. So I think there are probably another couple of dimensions to this, though. One is, you know, certainly in government, there, you know, we can talk about the role of data in democratic process. So improving transparency and accountability in government, that's the big drive in open government and open data. And then there's also this concept of democratization of data, which is citizen science and the ability to generate new insights from these digital smoke signals, the signals that people leave behind on their interactions with service providers, government service providers, and private sector on the web. And that's, you know, I think in the past, data was generated by government, map data, for example, or in the past, journalists or news was generated by journalists. Now we have everybody blogging, everyone's a photographer, everyone's producing maps. They can contribute to very large-scale mapping efforts through OpenStreetMap. They can contribute to knowledge bases through Wikipedia and those kinds of things. Everyone's their own journalist, everyone's their own photographer, and that's really democratized the production of information.
So when you talk about citizen science, you're talking about people contributing back. Citizens, everyday citizens, contributing what?
It's basically the leveraging the power of the community to go out and collect data or to perform some activity. So in environmental sciences, there are some really significant citizen science efforts where somebody will set up a citizen group, or a natural resource management agency will set up a citizen science project. And there are some tools through Atlas of Living Australia, something called BioCollect, which really is a mechanism to do that, where you set up a project. It might be looking for monitoring bilby populations in a particular location. You can develop a data collection form online, and you can ask people to then go out and collect the data and you know, observation data. It could be photographs, it could be sightings, and then contributing that into a pot of data. And that data is then used together with formal, authoritative, scientific government data to get a better picture of any given phenomena. So that's how it might work in something like the environment space. Citizen science, I think, is also, there have been some really significant beneficial outcomes in space sciences as well, with people looking at images and identifying phenomena. So another example from that community.
So yes, the democratization of data is another, I suppose it's another data source, but then data democracy itself is this, it's about rights and access. So different, you're seeing them as different but related?
Different but related, yes. So I think data democracy or the fundamental way in which we need to operate in this new data-rich world requires a better understanding of rights, better citizen education, so that we do the right thing by the subjects of the data and that we're able to optimize the system. And the role of citizen science and data generated about citizens going about their everyday life is part of that. So it feeds in. It's one of the new data sources that is becoming increasingly important and interesting to government, to private sector, to help us make better informed decisions.
So if you had one final word that you'd like to say to perhaps a policymaker, someone who's a custodian of a data set, is worried about the risks, what would you say to them that, what should they be thinking about?
I think the key issue is probably around managing the risks of disbenefit to organisation and to where personal information is concern, the disbenefit to the subjects of the data. And I know it's an easy thing to say, but typically more difficult to do given this issue of potential ability to re-identify. I think there's a need to streamline and improve our processes of the institutional mechanisms within organizations to help individual data owners, the people who are responsible for data within organizations, work through those processes and determine if they are able to release data and how they can do so in a safe way. So I think the work is required both probably more by organizations to improve tools and processes and guidance so that decision makers can operate in a more effective way around their data.
And what's in it for them to be more proactive in this area?
What's in it for them?
Yeah.
I think, again, there's probably some a variety of intrinsic and extrinsic motivators. So some majority of people, and it's a blanket statement probably about public sector, but people are typically working in the public sector to achieve public good outcomes. So I think there's a really strong intrinsic motivator to achieve the best value for money in the public sector for the money we use. So I think That's an interesting question.
Extrinsic and intrinsic motivators.
Yeah. I think there are the intrinsic motivators exist in the public sector because people are interested in achieving public good outcomes. But I think there's a role for institutions to establish the right kind of incentive structures that encourage and reward the right behavior. So again, that's maybe changing key performance indicators for public servants on the way that they release data. Because I think sometimes there isn't necessarily, activities don't necessarily get prioritized because organizations and individuals within organizations have to service the needs of that organization above and beyond everything else. That's their job, that's their core mission. And releasing data for reuse is a secondary objective, an important one, an increasingly important one. But I don't know whether necessarily organizations invest enough in streamlining that process so that the cost of doing that isn't too high. Because that's where I think we see some tension. People understand that it's the right thing to do, it's a good thing to do, it's beneficial, but again, we all have limited time that we can invest in doing our job and then doing these things that are not we don't necessarily get rewarded for.
Is there a danger that the wave is coming and that we have to start prioritising it, otherwise we'll be swamped? But then not being able to manage, would you say that it's on its way?
I think so. Yeah, I think there is a data deluge. It is happening now, and the degree to which you are experiencing that, again, depends on the nature of the work you do. But yeah, we do need to get out in front of this a little bit more and be a bit more proactive rather than reactive. And there's a lot that can be done in that institutional space, provided we understand where people are currently at in terms of their attitudes and practices and what the pain points are for them in actually getting this data more openly shared.
Is there anything else that you thought that you would like to mention during this interview that you feel like we might not have covered?
Maybe it's, do you touch in at all on kind of the use of data and data analytics? And the downstream things that can be done with data?
That'd be interesting. Yeah, yeah. What can be done with data and data analytics?
So I think there's a lot of the motivation to try to get data more openly available is being driven by our ability to do smart things with the data once we have it. So a lot of government agencies at Commonwealth and state territory level are investing in analytics capabilities, new analytics capabilities, where we're able to take different sources of data, different types of data, put it together and start to analyze it in new and interesting ways, given kind of the new techniques we have and enormous amounts of computing power, and drive insights to understand, you know, new things from the data, to do things that we couldn't do before because we couldn't put the data together or because we didn't have enough computing power to analyze it in these new ways. So I think there's a lot of interest in data analytics, and there's been a lot of really interesting new insights that have come out of these data analytic capabilities. One of the challenges is around how do we scale up, how do we scale that up? Because currently we have to, you know, a data scientist is set a policy challenge. They then have to go out and negotiate access to all the data, munge the data, that's a technical term, munge the data, pull it all together, harmonize it, interpret it, understand it before they can start doing the data science. So, and the big costly part of that is actually going out, knocking on lots of doors and negotiating access to data. If the data is available and well described and available via services so that you're getting the most up-to-date view of the data or continually updated data, then that removes an enormous cost for folk doing data analytics work. So again, I think that it points back to the need to think about and improve the data supply chains, because we know that data analytics can do some really smart stuff, but we need to feed these data analytics capabilities. I think another aspect of data analytics is also I think around social acceptance of some of these new techniques. So in scientific disciplines and in government practice, we have established regulated processes and analytic techniques which are agreed and understood and accepted. And I think there are some challenges around acceptance of the answers that come out of big data analytics and actually understanding how the insights that come from that are used in together with more traditional sources of data and data analytics, because they're maybe some of the analytic processes are a little bit maybe black box. We don't understand necessarily how they work. They haven't been tried and tested. They're just ways of delivering new insights in data. So actually putting those two processes together and using new techniques with new and emerging algorithms which interpret the world in a particular way, and comparing those to more traditional established, tested, and older ways or current ways of doing things.
So is that to test the accuracy of the new data analytics, or is it more about reconciling two different? I mean, is this one less authoritative or trustworthy? Or
I think it's about taking the strengths of both and using them in a complementary way. So you may be able to get an insight based on the data that you're analyzing, but you may want to confirm and validate that against existing, established, ground truthed, accepted ways of doing things. So actually understanding the relationship between those two approaches. And if we are going to be making significant policy decisions or investments based on these new techniques, we need to be sure that they're providing us with accurate information, accurate insights.
Can you give an example of where you're looking to, where this is sort of working, or of these two sort of the traditional and the new data model working together? So
I think there's some interesting things happening in the social services, you know, health education, looking at how, looking at correlations between people's interactions with health and education outcomes. So starting to look at these kind of very large complex data sets of how citizens are interacting with government services and what the causal relationships are. So does it make more sense to invest in a particular health outcome or a health intervention? What does the impact on educational outcomes look like? So looking at the system in a really holistic way. And in the past, we would have made policy decisions and investment decisions in those two domains separately. And now there's a possibility of starting to look across the two domains. So that isn't my area of expertise, but there's some interesting analytics that are being done in Australia and elsewhere looking at those kinds of things. Yeah.
Okay. No, that seems to be pretty...
Well, you just simply couldn't do that before, could you?
That's right. And part of that is around navigating the institutional arrangements that agencies in the health sector and education sector have, and very strict controls about how they're able to share data, but knowing that it makes sense to be able to share the data within government, anonymized, de-identified data, so that you can drive improved outcomes in both policy areas while respecting the legislation, privacy regulations, the mandates of both organisations. So it's a really quite a tricky space to navigate, but those kinds of activities are being done in very safe, secure, controlled environments where the information is anonymised and protected, and there's no chance of re-identification of individuals.
Okay.